to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes, and I'm coming to you not from out of the past. I'm coming to you from out of the present. It's happening right now. Be here now, man. That's my new motto. Not out of the past, and certainly not out of the future because of wormholes and things that it's none of your business. But not coming out of a wormhole, not coming out of any hole, as far as I've heard, not for a while, really. My good friend, my co-host, the man, the legend, the comedy legend, I call him, fodder for my canon, if you will, podcaster of the decade,
ooh,
nay, century? Basically invented comedy. I'm selling this perfectly right down that line. It's Corky McDonald. You know who it is. I didn't even need to say. He needs no introduction, and yet that introduction just went
yet
on and on.
They just get longer and longer and longer.
It's just the introductions. The less that you need an introduction, the longer the introduction gets, right?
It's
as
true.
Your legend grows, so grows your introduction.
Well, I just want to say thank you for all those wonderful superlatives you bestowed upon me, Dan.
I undersold you, if anything.
Jeez. Do we just talk about me the rest of the episode? This is...
Let's go. I mean, you want to talk about coming out of the past.
Out of the past is like a new name for This Is Your Life, and it's just you just going over all the great things I've done.
I'm into the past present, bro. Past participle. Dropping the participle and just sipping malt.
Sipple?
Classic improv.
When you said you didn't have an opening ready, I couldn't have told.
Yeah,
like fucking seamless. Like the Phantom Thread.
That
seamless.
David Mamet himself, right? Like that was punchy. It was taut. It was masculine. I said the F word 300 times. I don't know what else I can do here for you people.
We hardly moved.
It didn't move. I didn't move. I sold some insurance, but I didn't move.
I argued with Glengarry a law student account. That yeah. I'm having an affair with.
Oh, boy. You know, we love David Mamet, but boy.
You know who else we love?
Yeah. Ma'am, oh, ma'am. Do we?
We love our PayPal supporters. That's
King David. I call you because that's the kind of position you occupy in our hearts.
A ferocious, fearless
segue.
Just ever burning, passionate love we have for each one of our PayPal supporters, mm-hmm. the donors yeah. to the show, the superheroes, the King Davids, if you will.
Really,
we couldn't
really.
Do the show without you.
Yeah. And I'm going to take a slingshot.
Oh, boy.
And I'm going to say, if you'd like to donate to the show, head to daredaniel.com, find the menu at the top of the show, and click support the show. Corky biblical references. If you actually go back and listen to all like 300 or so episodes of Dare Daniel, Cannon Fodder, Single Take, mm-hmm. you will find nested in there many, many references to the end of days, okay?
Yeah.
Like, fuck your left behinds. Okay, leave
this
that
This isn't a podcast.
Behind.
This
all
is
right.
a Dan Brown yeah. novel. You
That's,
have to go
leave
through
behind
each
is,
one of our
left
episodes.
Behind's out of the past. I'm coming out of the future, man. And I am bringing...
I'm coming out of a cage, and I'm doing just fine.
But if you'd like to donate to the show and be a hero, survive the apocalypse, I'm not promising anything, but I'm not promising anything... Any contribution helps keep this show going. Thank you so much.
Today's episode, Out of the Past. The IMDb synopsis for Out of the Past? A private eye escapes his past to run a gas station in a small town, but his past catches up with him. Now he must return to the big city world of danger, corruption, double crosses, and duplicitous dames.
Duplicitous dames. Yeah, see? You're duplicitous, yeah. you dame. Yeah, Out of the Past, directed by Jacques Tourneur. It's his only film in the Sight and Sound Top 250, although I think he's kind of an unsung master. One of the really great underrated directors of the studio system era, and I think undoubtedly one of the great genre filmmakers of all time, horror, Western, film noir, just about anything he could do. I Walk with a Zombie, that's my favorite of his film, even more than Out of the Past, but also Stars in My Crown, Cat People, Canyon Passage, Great Day in the Morning, Stranger on Horseback. I could go on and on and on. Film stars Robert Mitchum, who we both loved in The Night of the Hunter, along with Kirk Douglas, Jane Greer, and Rhonda Fleming. It's adapted by Jeffrey Holmes, a.k.a. Daniel Mainwaring, from his 1946 novel Build My Gallows High, and that's a line that actually makes it into the film. It has uncredited revisions by James M. Cain, but apparently the more significant contributions came from Frank Fenton, who was very well-versed in the detective genre. Mitchum got the role after John Garfield and Dick Powell turned it down. Kind of hard to imagine with Dick Powell.
Dick Powell, he keeps coming up.
Well, I mean, he was a star. And he made Murder by Sweet in the 40s, which was a detective movie.
And he was a big radio star.
Sure, yeah.
Like, and, I get it.
Great tenor.
Right, he had a lovely singing voice.
Yeah, but it's just, that's a whole different movie.
That's a different movie, man.
This, a lot of times people look at this film and they say, oh, it's a Robert Mitchum, Kirk Douglas movie. Kirk Douglas, this was like his third movie. He was not the co-lead. He has maybe half a dozen scenes in this movie, right? Six, maybe seven scenes. Yeah. Only his third credited screen performance. So this was very, very early Kirk Douglas. But man, he just arrives as fully formed as any actor possibly could. I mean, it is Kirk Douglas right there on screen. The movie, it was well received. It turned a tidy little profit when it was released in 1947, but that was about it. Bosley Crowther, your boy, New York Times legend Bosley Crowther,
name.
In a mostly positive review, he said, quote, "If only we had some way of knowing what's going on in the last half of this film, we might get more pleasure from it. As it is, the challenge is worth a try." Even the Night of the Hunter screenwriter, James Agee, called it a medium-grade thriller. Pauline Kael was also not a big fan, and yet today, it is considered really the epitome of film noir, like the ultimate film noir, the ne plus ultra, if you will. Everything your mind conjures when you think about film noir, with the shadowy black and white photography, all these archetypes of the doomed male and the femme fatale, the bleakness, the fatalism, the themes of guilt and moral turpitude, it's all right here in Out of the Past. As much as quirky, if you remember Nick Ray's In a Lonely Place, we talked a lot on there about how it sort of subverts the genre, right? It's not exactly like a standard film noir, because like it works in kind of opposite ways. Like Lauren Bacall, for example, is not a, or sorry, Gloria Graham is not a femme fatale at all, right? Like she's a tragic heroine, right? But here, you get two femme fatales, right? If anything, they're over-delivering on the film noir and Out of the Past. The movie was remade in 1984 as Against All Odds. Yeah, that Against All Odds, with Jeff Bridges, Rachel Ward, and James Woods filling in for Mitchum, Greer, and Douglas, and Phil Collins filling in for no one. But he won an Oscar, I think, right?
Against that All song's Odds. A banger.
Yeah. Oh, it still hits. Still hits 40
Phil Collins
years later.
Had no business being as great as he was, like 82 to 85.
Yeah, and yet he made it his business, by golly. It's so quirky. You know, I think as I was alluding earlier, In a Lonely Place, if we go back to that episode, you were initially sort of a little wary, but you kind of came around over the course of the episode. Any wariness at all here about crowning Out of the Past as a canon-worthy classic?
I would like to be mysterious, kind of like maybe hide what I'm thinking a little bit.
Just in the shadows, smoking a cigarette.
But I'm darkly off a line lit or right two. Now.
Right.
So you know I'm revealing the truth. No, this movie was great, man. It is what noirs try to copy. Like it is when you think of a noir, it's just this side of parody of a noir, because it hits those notes so fucking hard.
Yeah.
And it's kind of perhaps this is why noirs copy this style, because this nailed it so fucking well.
Mm-hmm.
From your rugged man with a mysterious past, your femme fatale who is the femmest of the fatalist of femme fatales, to a good heavy bad guy pulling strings, and you got the good girl that can never be obtained and is never going to be happy. You know this man is doomed from the second we see him on screen. Mm-hmm. His past is catching up to him no matter where he went. I don't know any of his other films. Mm-hmm. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
But the cinematographer, Nick Masuraco or something.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Like the way the light and dark plays in this movie, especially on Kathy, the way the light and the dark plays on her and changes her from scene to scene. I object to Bosley Crowther painting what we don't know what's happening in the last half of this movie as a negative. I think muddled motives and when are people lying and when are they telling the truth is what noir is about.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Fucking that's what made this movie so much. She is amazing. Not just her performance, but that character is so good.
That character is really, really fantastic. And so is his character, Jeff. That's the Robert Mitchum character. I will admit, I almost always get lost in like murder mysteries, especially like really mm-hmm. twisty murder mysteries, partly because I'm just not very good at remembering names, right? So it's like people always reference someone's name and I'm like, who the fuck was that? Like, give me a clue. What color was their hair? And it's like, it's black and white, gray. It's all gray. Here, it doesn't matter. You could just get dumped into any random scene in this film, and it is such an orgy of style and attitude. It is so like sensual and yet bitterly fatalistic at the same time. And here you have Robert Mitchum as Jeff, your perfect noir hero. Like, you know, some people say their integrity is beyond question. With Robert Mitchum, his corruptibility is beyond question. You don't bat an eye when he goes, when he breaks bad. You're not like, really? Oh, what?
I didn't expect right? it from and this guy.
And he's the good guy. He's the good guy here, more or less, right? You know, as good as they get here. But he's so, like, unflappable. Like, you just mm-hmm. cannot, like, rattle this dude, even as he is sinking into quicksand, right? Like, he just walks into one setup after another, and there's nothing that he can do or will do. Like, it just plays out. It's like that great scene where they go to the lawyer's house, who they're going to blackmail the lawyer, and he's realizing as it's happening in real time,
he's in a frame.
Oh, I'm being set up.
Yeah,
here are my fingerprints on the glass. Oh, talk about your cousin. Oh yeah, he's a bookmaker in Cincinnati or whatever, right? Like, he's realizing it in real time. What's he gonna do? He just has to play it out. It's this weird thing where it's like he is so easy to manipulate and yet he's somehow above manipulation. You know, it's just this weird thing with Mitchum and with this character of Jeff. He's on this conveyor belt of doom and he can't get off, but he's going to get his licks in first before he meets his doom. And Kathy, that's Jane Greer's character, just as unflappable. Right, mm-hmm. just as unflappable, even more unflappable. She doesn't break at all.
No,
she's never talking about like her cousin in Cincinnati or anything like that. She gets caught red-handed and never for a moment admits guilt, at least any more guilt than she needs to admit. And she murders people in cold blood. And if she were wearing an Apple Watch, her pulse would not have risen one little bit, right? Like, nothing at all. Yeah, and that's just what is so great about everything's great about this movie. Dialogue's great, visuals are great, as you said, the use of light and shadow, the performances are outstanding, even down to like supporting players are great. Rhonda Fleming as femme fatale number two, meta fatale, if you will. Paul Valentine, as Douglas's body man.
The little kid.
Everything is... Oh, the kid too, right? Yeah. Everything here is just... It's outstanding. The story is outstanding.
The
way it's structured with the flashback taking up most of the first, third of the movie or so. That's most of the first half is a flashback told during a road trip. you know, to characters we don't really know that well. It's very audacious, you know, in that way.
We talk about so much the movies that do these things incorrectly, and then when you see a movie that does it right, a flashback during a road trip where you have flashbacks within a flashback, I'm thinking Ryan's Babe. Yeah. I am thinking Ryan's Babe. A movie where the man narrates his own doom. Like, how is he doing that? I'm thinking Ryan's Babe. Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, fucking nay.
And the dialogue is just vintage, just hard-boiled noir.
Every line.
Dialogue.
Every line.
But there's two essential exchanges that I want to talk about here very quickly, because I think they really sum up the existential despair that is really at the heart of the genre of film noir. Like, the style aspect, you know, is there. But theme-wise, I think there's this existential despair. So there's one exchange between Jeff and Kathy in front of a roulette wheel where he says, "That's not the way to win." She says, "Is there a way to win?" And he says, "There's a way to lose more slowly."
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Kathy says, "I don't want to die." And Jeff says, "Neither do I, baby. But if I have to, I'm going to die last," right?
Yeah.
Like, Jeff knows in his heart he is going to lose. He knows he is going to die. Those things are written. Those things are going to happen. His victory, if you will be to lose more slowly and die last, if at all possible. And I don't think he actually makes it, because she kills him just before the car crashes. She beats him by like 5 seconds at the very end. Spoiler alert for a 80-year-old film. But yeah, they all die at the end. Well, except the good people. The really good people, which are the small town folk from this mountain town, which is where we start in here, which is kind of an unexpected way to start the film. Not in the big city, right? But kind of right out in the pines near Lake Tahoe, right? It's sort of out there somewhere in the Sierra Nevadas or the foothills.
Yeah, in the East Sierras. And we start, and there's a really great shot at the beginning that's almost kind of like just a signpost telling you where everywhere you actually want to be is and how far away. But it's like this visual cue of like, your past is not that far away. And your past can get here. You know what I mean? Like, it might as well say past 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, that's when your past is going to catch up to you, pal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Bridgeport. This is the opening scenes are set in the town of Bridgeport, which I don't think there is a Bridgeport in California here.
Yeah, there is.
But, you know, is there?
Yeah.
This is a real town?
What? By, like, Lake Mono?
Well, there you go. Bridgeport. So they're out there in Bridgeport. And right away, the title, it makes good on the promise of the title, the film does, because he has a chance encounter from out of the past.
Yep.
Right? And that's draws Jeff Bailey. I mean, he put his name right there on the sign. It's not his real name, as we find out. His name is Jeff Markham. And boy, is this guy a mark, right? Like, mark him down, because like, this guy's in the bag.
Won't you come home, Jeff Bailey? Won't you come home?
But yeah, it's this chance. Well, it's not really a chance encounter, because actually, as we find out, this guy, the chance encounter happened like a week or so ago, or however long
we
ago.
Start with the idyllic happy ending. Like, if this movie ended right there, you'd be like, oh, this is lovely. These two people are in love. They're going to have a wonderful future together. And that is the best that it's ever going to be for both of them, the rest of this movie. And I never thought Robert Mitchum was a handsome guy. I never thought that. Like, he was always kind of off beat looking to me, but him in this suede fishing jacket, he fills it out really well. He's got like a feathered hair. It's lighter than it usually is. He looks really good. He's a very handsome man.
He's got it going on, absolutely. And he's also got it going on with goody goody small town girl Anne. Good old Anne. So she's the good girl, and the waitress in the local cafe spills everything to
small town shit
to the gunsel who just wants her sent right to the
Dude, this to, guy could not look killer. More. So what do you say? See, tell me everything.
Yes, absolutely. He's got fabulous written all over him.
He oozes into the shop.
Yes, absolutely. But she still lets it all go, and about how. I don't remember his name, but the good guy of the town. The he's like the local like
Jimmy or Johnny or some shit.
Yeah, he's just he's a good guy. He's known Anne since they were kids. He's kind of figured they're gonna go together and all that and stuff. But like, I mean, fucking hey, Robert Mitchum wanders into Bridgeport. Yeah. Jimmy the cop looks pretty fucking garbagey, right? And this guy just runs a gas station, so like it's not even like glamorous or anything, but it's just like, yeah, you look like garbage now. Sorry, Jimmy. But unfortunately he's drawn back into the past. Like we said, with this whole first act, mostly after this kind of initially sort of cryptic introduction where we're like, how do we fit into this? You know, like it starts with the car pulling into the garage and the cafe and everything, and where is Jeff? And we don't know where he is and stuff. Well, finally, he's drawn back to Whit Sterling. That's Kirk Douglas's character. Yeah. He's just a criminal, and he's staying at the old Corleone place. Always get shivers when I walk by the old Corleone place out there in Lake Tahoe. Yeah, he's on some just luxury, you know, place right by the lake there. And Jeff is drawn back there, but he spills it all on the ride there, right?
He tells the whole thing.
Yeah. So Anne hears all about it. And in a nutshell, him and his partner, his gumshoe partner, they were hired by Whit to find Kathy, and that's Jane Greer, who shot Whit and stole $40,000. He tracks her to Acapulco, and they fall in love. They escape together, but his partner finds him and she kills him, runs off with the money, and it turns out she had just been lying to him the entire time about the money, about everything, and there you go, right? Like, it's just this really tragic tale, but it's also just, like, dripping with, like, sexuality and sensuality and fatalism, and there's that great line. I mean, gosh, there's so many fucking great lines, but the line about Jeff where they come together, right? They come together through sort of a meet cute, right? Like with the guide who's a really bad guide.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a meet cute there. They come together finally. And once they do, he has this line where he says, "I never saw her in the daytime. We seem to live by night. What was left of the day went away like a pack of cigarettes you smoked. I don't know where she lived. I never followed her. All I ever had to go on was a place and time to see her again. I don't know what we were waiting for. Maybe we thought the world would end."
Jeez.
I mean, that's just like, maybe fingers crossed for the apocalypse, right? Like, this is the attitude of this film. This is where Jeff's head is living, right? Like, he finds something good with Anne, but he knows everything bad, but also kind of everything that he wants is here with Kathy, you know?
You know what I got straight vibes of? Airplane, man. Every time Ted Stryker would start to reminisce about him in the lane.
Right.
But, I mean, that's how indelible this kind of shit was for filmmakers who grew up watching that stuff, you know?
Oh, truly, truly. Yeah, this is, you know, and it's not like this movie, you know, invented film noir or invented any of this stuff, really. Like, a lot of times we can kind of overrate or underrate a film because we perceive it as the first or not the first to do something. And almost always we're wrong when we say that. Like so much of the film history is like lost to history. So we have no way of knowing that really anyway. But we see it as like, if it was the first, so it's groundbreaking. But this, you could put this again in a vacuum, in a contextless void. This is a great film. Drop into any scene.
Right.
This is a great film.
Yeah.
Drop in at the beginning. Watch it back to front, front to back. It's such a great movie, and its greatness just keeps unfolding over and over
again. If you want to talk about the time, like, it's just a style of the way movies were made at that time. Like, they didn't call them noirs. It wasn't like a thing that, like, we're making a film noir. Like, that term comes later. You know what I mean? To define this style that was so ever present in that era.
Yeah, they the studio that was making it saw this as like a detective movie.
Yeah.
Or a crime film, or, you know, a gangster movie or something like that. And all those things are present, you know, but they weren't necessarily thinking like, yeah, this is a film noir, and here's what makes it a film noir according to Eddie Muller or according to whoever else, right? They were just trying to make an awesome film, and shit, they made it. So back to present.
In this whole like flashback, there's compelling moments. Like, are they going to get caught? You know what I mean?
Yes, because Wit just shows up all of a sudden. And it's really funny when he shows up too. There's all like, he shows up and it's surprising. And then Wit says like, oh, I hate surprises too. Should I just leave? It's like, and it's so menacing at the same time. Like, it's really funny.
You never know how much everybody knows, and if they're full telling the truth. And Kirk Douglas is really good in this, in that he's Wit Stillman. His money status is higher than Jeff.
Wit Sterling.
Not Wit Stillman. That would be a very different portrayal.
He's a maker of twee indie films.
Yes. The whole movie just features 90s yuppies bouncing around Manhattan.
Chloe Sevigny's in this? I had no idea. What is this?
But his money status is higher than Jeff. His career status is higher than Jeff. But he knows he's lost his woman to Jeff. He's at the threat of doing it. He can't find his woman without Jeff. Mm. His flunky is no damn good. And
yes,
he plays it
really dumb.
In a way of, I'm insecure, even though I should be the big heavy bad guy. Like, I'm coming to you to solve my problem.
He has this like fake sort of jolly attitude, right? Where he's always sort of smiling and kidding, but you're like, underneath that is just pure venom and hatred, and all he wants to do is just snap your neck and just suck the blood out of you. Like, he hates your guts, but he is smiling his ass off at you.
And you can tell what he's really scared of is getting taken down by fucking taxes. Like, he's really scared of the IRS. Like,
but I mean, it's an accurate portrayal of the rich. Yeah. Yes. Holds true today, 80 years later. Yeah. But yeah, so he gets Jeff now. This whole like flashback thing ends and like forgives him and says like, well, it's all in the past, you know, and it ain't, right?
Because, bah, bah, bah.
We've heard, we know. And who does he find there at the estate? But Kathy. Kathy, remember last time she had an encounter with Wit, tried to murder him.
Yeah.
And stole $40,000.
Swears she didn't.
Which is a lot of money now. Imagine, you know, you say it's a lot of money then. It was a lot of money then, too. Really a lot of money then. But she's back with him. She's back. All good.
Yep.
Right? Like, what the fuck? But he rejects her, but he still gets wrapped into this plot, which involves, like you said, taxes. Like, his lawyer is apparently blackmailing him for tax evasion. You wonder, like, was the lawyer actually blackmailing him for tax evasion? I just thought of this, but like, was that just paranoia on the part of?
I think so. Wit? I think it's I'm not controlling this.
Like,
enough.
He knew that his lawyer knew that his lawyer, this is the guy who did it, did some dirty tricks to save him $1 million on taxes, and now he's like, oh, can't trust this guy, right?
He's going to spill if he gets subpoenaed or something.
Yeah. And so this guy, his secretary, whose name is Meta. What a great name, Meta. And what a great woman, Rhonda Fleming. Hello.
I watched this movie and I'm like, man, she is lovely. And then they called her a redhead. I'm like, oh, okay, so that's what a redhead looks like in black and white. Like, I wouldn't guess.
I know. She looks great in color too.
Yeah.
Trust me. Trust Strictly Scarlet or whatever that name. Fantastic. Anyway, Jeff tries to warn this guy, but he still finds him murdered, right?
Like, yeah, now we're in San Francisco.
In San Francisco now.
This hard-boiled detective noir
has
taken place
about it.
In the bustling burgs of Bridgeport, California.
Yeah,
Tahoe,
Lake Tahoe,
and Acapulco.
Acapulco, right? And now we're in San Francisco. Like, finally, sort of noirish, right? Maltese
yeah,
Falcon took place
maybe,
there,
Philip
right?
Marlo,
that's something. That's something. But yeah, it is funny. This is like the kind of undermining thing of this movie is that a lot of it takes place in locations that you don't consider very noirish, but like the attitude, the style, certainly carries over. But anyway, this is Jeff does this whole thing that's very clever, where he finds the body, but then hides the body.
Yeah.
And the one time we actually see Kathy break,
yeah,
is because she has no idea that anyone's in the room. Right? Finally, he hears her. It's so cold, right? She's arranging for this body to be discovered.
She's at a fucking swanky party, excuses herself. Yeah. You wouldn't know that there was an ounce of like trepidation on her. Goes to make the phone call to confirm the body's dead, and then gets bad news. And that's the one time.
Yeah, that's the one time you see it. You see her be like, wait, what the fuck's going on? And Jeff sees it too. And that's the end. That's the end for them. And apparently she signed also an affidavit indicating Jeff.
But they made me do it, Jeff. She knows when to turn on the doe eyes. She can talk
absolutely
her way out of anything.
No, and she's never going to apologize, and she's never going to admit more than you know. She'll admit what you know, maybe, if she has to. But even caught gun in hand, literally smoking gun, she still will say, like, I had to do it, you know. So anyway, Kathy even arranges for, you know, Joe to tail, not Jeff, but the kid. We haven't talked about him, but the deaf kid.
Yeah.
Who we meet at the very beginning. He works at Jeff's, well, he works for Jeff doing like odd jobs and stuff like that, and they're friends and everything. But like he is also kind of Jeff's keeper in a way. Like he looks out for Jeff, right?
Yeah.
As Jeff's hiding, he brings him stuff as Jeff's, you know, if Jeff's out fishing, he knows where he is, you know. So this kid knows, you know, more than he lets on, really, as we find out, especially at the last shot of the movie. But I do love this scene of this kid killing Joe with the fishing line. Joe, the tough guy, he just gets brought down by a fishing line, you know. It's just really funny. But that's it's good stuff. But I won't go into the detail. We won't go into the full details of the ending. But just safe to say, it's just very like a brutal, fatalistic ending for Jeff and for Kathy. The ending they both probably deserve. She certainly deserves it. He, you know, well, yeah, we go back and forth maybe a little bit, but the enigmatic final scene with the kid, you know, what he gives some information to Kathy and sort of like, how did you read that scene? Did you read that as him giving her what she needed, him giving her what Jeff told him, hear him just sort of intuiting, like, what did you think was going on in that final scene?
I kind of think that was a wise beyond his years kind of thing from the kid. It was a don't let this...
Time to move on.
Yes. Get out of your past. Yeah. He's the past now.
Yeah.
Go forward with Jimmy or Johnny or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great point, right? Yeah. Like, Jeff's in the past. Jeff's gone. Time to move on. You know, Jeff couldn't move on. Jeff could never move on. Wit couldn't move on. Joe couldn't move on. Kathy couldn't move on.
The cab
Netta
driver
move on.
That
Eels
he knew in San Francisco. How did he know this cab driver in San Francisco so well that the guy was like on call?
Right? I know. That guy was Johnny on the spot. That guy was very, very useful at a key point in the film. That's for sure. Yeah, love that guy. And it also leads to one of the best and kind of most prototypical lines in the film, and kind of an essential line for noir and about femme fatales, especially where the Rhonda Fleming gets out of the cab and the cab driver says something like, wow, nice. You know, that's what we're all thinking, right?
Yeah.
And Robert Mitchum says, just a little cold around the heart.
That's so
like
good.
It really is. And it's just, again, he tosses it off just like it's absolutely nothing. And that's just the real key to this performance. All right, Corky, that's out of the past. Anything we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to bring up before we give our ratings and wrap it up?
When we first meet Jeff, well, when Jeff comes back to his gas station and first sees Joe is hanging around, you know Jeff Bailey doesn't play by rules because there's a lot of smoking next to gas pumps. And those gas pumps are right, yeah, absolutely. Not just, they're casually tossing cigarettes. They're casually tossing lit matches. I was like, Jesus Christ, oh boy, you guys. Yeah.
Omnipresent cigarettes. There's one scene in the film, like in that first scene where Mitchum and Douglas meet, where Douglas offers him a cigarette and he says, smoking. You know, he just has one already. That apparently was an ad lib because he didn't realize they were just nonstop smoking. He didn't realize he was actually already smoking. Was like, oh, wait, shit. And then there's a callback to it later on. So I don't know how if that's apocryphal or not, but either way, it's a great
story. It sounds
story.
Too good to be true.
No, it's just like, yeah, like they were smoking so much. They were like, oh, I got one in both hands. Never mind. I'm good. Yeah. Anyway, anything else you wanted to bring up?
I did read that last shot was an accident.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah. The kid stayed in character staring. And Turnier just let it go and let it run, saw the moment happening and was like, no, this is good, and held.
Beautiful. Well,
yeah.
That's a great
director.
Oh, and
Turnier didn't really have a shot list for the day that he was in. The cinematographer was like, you're fucking crazy. What are we doing here? And they would toy around with different lighting techniques. And they decided, fabulous. I think I read that they decided light meant lies and darkness meant telling the truth. So when she's really well lit, she's, okay, no, I'm sorry. I'm bouncing all around. But my favorite fucking part, when his former partner confronts them, he's smart enough that he doesn't tail Jeff because Jeff is good at losing Fisher. The tail, but he tails her. When they get into a fist fight, him and his former partner, the look on her face... She is loving this.
Yes.
Like there's
it's all
this
in the eyes, right? She's
there's
just,
this woman who can give you the sweetest doe-eye innocence. She is aroused.
Yeah.
And unguarded
invested. Moment.
And this is like, okay, you can see her recalibrating however this shakes out. I gotta put a con on. And then she kills the guy. And it's like she got worked up to a frenzy.
Like, yeah, right?
This woman can't help but kill people.
Oh, almost to like the shooting of a gun as like an ejaculatory kind of an orgasmic moment. She got worked up into a sexual frenzy, really, right? Like, I mean, she was, victor gets the prize, and that's me. And you know what? I'm actually going to go ahead and choose the victor because one of them works for me and one of them doesn't, right? Fisher, not so much, but Jeff Markham, just perfect.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Hmm. The only people we see kill people are her and the kid. Joe kills the lawyer, but he's like kind of like fucked up about it. Like he feels good.
Yeah.
Those two kill with impunity, like nothing. Like the kid couldn't say a thing about it if he wanted to, but still he's protecting Jeff, but he still kills Joe. And then she tries to kill Kirk Douglas, does kill Kirk Douglas, also kills the old partner.
Yeah,
like that's a twist on a noir where the only killers are a woman and a child.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it's funny. It's like, the ending hinges on her saying like, either go with me, or be on the hook for three murders.
Yeah,
which is Eels the lawyer.
I have no qualms. Let you
Fisher
take
the detective and Wit, but then like. There's also a fourth corpse, right? Which is Joe. No one's on the hook for Joe's murder. Sorry, Joe.
He's just befouling the Tahoe River.
You're out, buddy. Yeah, you're Patton Oswalt in Magnolia, as far as we're concerned. anyway, yeah, it's
Delmer Darren, wasn't that his name?
Right. Yes. Oh, good stuff. Anything else quirky about Out of the Past?
No, that's it.
Just remind everybody about our rating system. Of course, we rate on the slight or sound scale. If we both think that this was a sound selection, fully canon-worthy, then kaboom, light the cannons, and into the cannon fodder cannon you go. If one or both of us think it was a little slight, No canon. Sorry, buddy, but we will select a selected film not in the Sight and Sound Top 250 to put in its place. But Quirky, I think I know the answer to this. Out of the Past, Sight or Sound?
Oh, it's sound. It is quite sound. Like the sound of something you think about in your past. I don't know. it is pitch perfect in its tone, in the dialogue. It's that truly noir-esque kind of Dashiell Hammett. Everything has a retort. Everything's like a setup for a good retort. Just walks that fine line of almost being a parody of itself. And the story is fantastic. Like, it's just so good. The twists and the turns that it takes, and the obscure nature of everybody's motive, not everybody's motives, but most of the people's motives, and the fact that he just can't quit his past, and you know it from the start. It's really fucking good.
I fully agree. Yeah, I think Jacques Turner, what I really like about him, one of the things I really love about him as a filmmaker, especially a genre filmmaker in this era, is that he's a really great outdoors director. Mm. So many films from this era shot on sound stages and backlots, and you think of this and you don't think like, oh yeah, it's a film noir. Beautiful outdoor photography, but there really is here.
Yeah.
His film before this was called Canyon Passage, which is a Western set in the Pacific Northwest, and it has that real feel to it. It's a very unique kind of a setting for a Western. It has that outdoor feel to it as well. Other movies like Stranger on Horseback and Way of the Gaucho, and I think he was just a really outstanding director, genre filmmaker, but also movies set outdoors in nature, in the pampas and in the forests and in the desert and everywhere else. So I think it's fantastic. I also want to single out a line from Wit about Joe. Poor old Joe, killed by a fishing line. Where he says, Joe couldn't find a prayer in the Bible. That's a good line. That's a good line. Joe couldn't find a prayer in the Bible. Oh,
and probably said right in front of Joe, right? Like,
right there. Right there. Yeah, he's like, well, why doesn't Joe find him? Joe couldn't find a prayer in the Bible. Sorry, Joe. And I hope you found some sort of peace. And I know I found peace because absolutely this is a sound selection.
Hell yeah.
And kaboom, right into the cannon fodder canon it goes. I think this is finally the 70th film. We were stuck on 69. I'm stuck on 69.
Ooh, boy.
But we were stuck on 69, really. And now we're not.
That's what we thought about Out of the Past. What did you yourself think about it? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on it. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us all your thoughts.
But now, of course, it's time to select the film we'll be reviewing in 2 weeks on our next episode. Quirky, you ready to make this happen?
Let's go, baby.
All I got to do is push the button. I get a number randomly generated to me. Button has been pushed. It corresponds to a list. And that list has at number 42 a little movie called La Atalante. Do you know La Atalante, Quirky? I think we mentioned it on the show maybe briefly. The Jean Vigo movie from 1934. French film? Anything? Nothing?
No.
This is a legendary movie. Jean Vigo is a legendary director. I mean, he is like the Rimbo or the Kurt Cobain of early filmmaking. I mean, he died at like 26, 27 years old. He had made just two or three films. La Atalante was his last, and it was his absolute masterpiece. I'll read you the letterbox synopsis. Newly married couple Juliet and ship captain Jean struggle through marriage as they travel on the La Atalante, along with the captain's first mate and a cabin boy. It stars Michel Simon and Di Tiparlo. It is available to watch on the Criterion channel, if you have that. It's also available to rent on any of your finer VOD services. Quirky, it's only 88 minutes long. It's an early sound film. It's set on a riverboat. I mean, it's all atmosphere and everything else. How excited are you about this one?
I'm excited that I think this is our second film named after a boat. There's...
The Potemkin.
Bomb Accord?
Potemkin and Armacore, right? Yeah.
This will be our third then.
Fantastic.
We got a whole new category of movies.
Yeah. Poseidon Adventure next, maybe? We'll see.
Titanic. That's what we're doing next, Titanic.
It's going to be a little bit of a departure from the list. But La Atalante, I have seen this film a couple of times. It's been a while, though. I'd say it's been at least probably 20 years or so for me. So I'm really excited to watch this film again. I think it's just kind of a magical movie. And Jean Vigo is one of those great, like, you know, what if he had, you know, lived another 40, 50 years? What if he had the career like Jean Renoir had that great long career, or Louis Buñuel? Just a fantastic movie. So I'm excited to talk about it in a couple of weeks with you, my good friend Quirky.
Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. We will voraciously love you. If you are a fan of new movies, listen to Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I am Daniel Barnes. Until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.